Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll check in with Wyoming-based writer Craig Johnson, the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels, which are the basis for Longmire, the Netflix series. The latest novel in the series, the 20th, is First Frost. Here's a bit of the plot. It's the summer of 1964, and recent college graduates Walt Longmire and Henry Standing Bear read the writing on the wall in a list to serve in the Vietnam War. As they catch a few final waves in California before reporting for duty, a sudden storm assaults the shores and capsizes a nearby cargo boat. Walt and Henry jump to action. It's soon revealed by the police that greet them ashore that the sunken boat carried valuable contraband for underground sources. Tooth and Claw novella will be released in November. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll check back in with Wyoming-based writer Craig Johnson, the New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels, which are the basis for the Longmire Netflix series. His latest novel in the Longmire series is the 20th. It's called First Frost. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about Tooth and Claw novella, which is set to be released November 19th. Craig Johnson is recipient of the Western Writers of America's Spur Award for Fiction, the Mountains and Plains Booksellers Award for Fiction, the Nouvel Observatoire Prix du Roman Noir, and the Prix NNCF du Polar. His novella Spirit of Steamboat was the first one-book Wyoming selection. He lives in Ucross, Wyoming, population 25. Craig Johnson, thanks for joining us again.
Hey, wonderful to be here. Hey, you know, your French is really good.
Yeah, I've... I've dabbled just a little bit in some romance languages, so enough to get the pronunciation.
Even my dog thinks that your French is really good.
your dog's a connoisseur, I guess, huh?
Yeah, she is. Like, she thinks she is, that's for sure.
So Ucross, I always get this wrong, population 25, or has it changed since we talked to you last?
You know what? It actually has. After 40 years, it's gone up one, and it's causing a major uproar here in the UCLA area. That would be Ucross, Claremont, Leiter, and Arvada. Like that. And we went up one after 40 years, like that, and we're trying to figure out what that one person is. Nobody had a baby. Nobody moved in, so we're just trying to figure out, you know, where that one person came from. Nobody seems to have any answers so far, so we'll see what happens.
See what happens, but still probably no traffic jams in Ucross.
No, it's actually pretty nice that way. We don't know what lines are. We don't know what traffic jams are. Unless people are moving cows. If you're moving cows, then there's a little bit of a traffic jam. But other than that, you know, we're in pretty good shape.
I've experienced that a couple times driving the high country of Wyoming. You have to wait, you know. Have to wait for the cows.
Yeah, there's no way to go around. Look at it, so you just got to wait until they have their way first. Look at it, so, yeah. And animals go first.
So I understand, if I got this right, you were recently in France.
We were just, we just finished a French book tour. We were over there for, I guess, pretty much the whole month of October, which was spectacular like that. And I laugh about it sometimes because I think to myself, okay, if somebody would have told me, okay, there's going to be a foreign country that these books about the sheriff of the least populated county in the least populated state are going to be a runaway hit in, you know, which one do you think it'll be? Maybe France wouldn't have been the first guess that I would have made. Look, it's been kind of interesting like that, but I've got a really fantastic publisher over there and a really wonderful translator, and the more languages that I get translated into, I think I've translated into about 23 languages so far like that, but I've come to the conclusion that, you know, if you get a good translation, you get a good book, and if you don't get a good translation, then you don't get a good book. And it seems to have paid off quite well in France. I don't know, it's interesting, I have to admit.
Do you get any input on the translator, or does the publisher just choose a translator? Luck of the draw.
I was lucky. Like the one that got assigned to me for the very first book, you know, she was very excited about it, like that, because she'd always been a big fan of the American West, you know, and interested in it and everything. And so she actually came over here, like that, and stayed, you know, with us here at the ranch for, like, you know, about 3 weeks, just kind of soaking in the area and kind of getting a feel for it and everything. And I think it comes through in the books. I think that her familiarity, you know, with the area and everything is at a large scale effect, you know, on the translation of the book.
So what's the interaction with fans in France? Is very similar to a signing in Wyoming or somewhere?
Well, my French is not as good as yours, like, yeah. So I have to admit that, you know, they don't ever turn me loose, you know, by myself, like that. They don't want to try to avoid, like, it any kind of like international incident like that. And so they pretty much put us out on the road for a couple of weeks. And, you know, Paris is usually the hub like that, but then we travel around all over the country. And I've been there, I think it's 31 times, like, you know, since the book started getting published there about 16 years ago. And, you know, my wife, you know, she speaks a little bit of French like that, but they make sure that we have somebody with us pretty much at all times, like to take care of everything and make sure, like I said, that we don't have any kind of international incident or anything like that. But yeah, the readers are fantastic. Like, they're really, really wonderful. They're smart readers. They're very interested, you know, in the contemporary American West. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that's always been of interest to me, like that is what the view is of my home, you know, in other places. And, you know, I mean, there are a couple of things, like at the, you know, I mean, you got to give credit where credit is due. I think Buffalo Bill Cody was probably responsible for, you know, implanting, you know, that idea of the epic, romantic American historical West all those years ago. Like, and then it was kind of explained to me to a certain extent that, you know, the Western was very, very popular in Europe after World War II, simply because, you know, most of those countries were in a rebuilding phase, and so we kind of inundated them, you know, with all of our novels, with all of our movies, and later all of our television. And what was the predominant art form at that point in time? It was the Western, like that. And so, you know, we kind of had a built-in following at that point in time, which is kind of waning a little bit here in the last like 10 years or so. But fortunately, like that, there's enough of a curiosity about what's going on over here now that it sustains, you know, us being in the bestsellers list.
So that Romantic Western is a foundation, but what is it, do you think, about the contemporary American West that holds fascinating for somebody in France, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, they realize, like, I mean, I try and write the books as honestly as I can. I mean, obviously, you know, you have to have a plot, you have to have development and all these things like that. But nonetheless, you know, I mean, one of the worst things that could ever possibly happen would be somebody, you know, from France, you know, fly over like that, or Germany, or, you know, Spain or anywhere else, like, fly over like that, you know, and land here in Wyoming in an airplane like that, and look around and go, this is nothing like what's in Craig Johnson's books. And so I think that, you know, that there's, you know, an honesty, I think, you know, to the play. Look at it in the way that it's portrayed. There's an intelligence to the characters, I think they respond to, and then there's also humor, which I'm always amazed, you know, whenever anybody leaves humor out, you know, in especially, you know, in crime fiction like that, because you're dealing with very weighty issues, you know, of life and death, and the only way to deal with those things is, you know, with a light hand and to have a little bit of a sense of humor. And so from what I've been told, like at the descriptive passages and the humor are very, you know, strong elements, you know, for foreign readers.
I was reading a couple of interviews you gave that where you said that you kind of stumbled into the humor, and that was a saving grace, because you were treating, you do treat very serious issues, and, you know, Longmire at the beginning, you start him out kind of depressed, right? So
that was kind of a dangerous thing to do. I mean, yeah. Anytime you start out a book, and it wasn't a series at that point in time, but when you start out a book like that, or a series of books like that, and have a protagonist who's clinically depressed, you could be writing clinically depressed novels, like, and so everybody wants to read that. And so, you know, one of the elements that I gave him, like that, you know, just as a survival technique, was, you know, to let him have that sense of humor, like to let him be smart, let him be well read. And so, you know, I mean, if you're trapped, I mean, the books are written in first person, so you're kind of trapped in Walt's head, you know, for 350, 400 pages, like, and so it better be a fun place to be, even if bad things are happening, like that. And, you know, I just finished, you know, I do a Christmas story every year, like that I, you know, send out for free to all the readers, like at, you know, off of the website, and then also do excuse me, like at about a dozen library events all over like northern Wyoming. And I, you know, the balance for that one, of course, is that I've got, you know, Walt happening to babysit a sourdough starter for his dispatcher, you know, on a very busy Christmas Eve, like that. And so, you know, to me, you know, a lot of times it doesn't have to be about murder and mayhem. You know, sometimes it can just be about the job. You know, sometimes it can just be about, you know, what the work is like in law enforcement. You know, and how that you know, that sense of humor is a very important element.
Babysitting a sourdough starter, that's very Western.
I don't know much about that. I got to tell you, I started from ground zero. Like we were doing an event, I think over in Ten Sleep, like that, and there was a place where we were staying, and they brought out this incredible. This was last year. This really incredible cranberry and walnut, you know, sourdough. And I had some. I was like, this is incredible. Like, and they started telling me like a sourdough starter was like 150 years old, and I was like, what? And it broke the whole news to me about how, you know, you've got to feed it, you know, you've got to take care of it. It's like a pet, for goodness sake. Like, and some of these things, like, I mean, I think they're even like, you know, some of them are like 1,000 years old, you know, that they've brought back, you know, by giving them water, like that yeast and everything. And so I thought, oh, this sounds like a Walt Longmire situation is what it sounds like. So it's the short story is called Starter's End is what it's called. I'll leave you to figure out the plot from that. So.
We'll look forward to that. So I want to talk about First Frost a little bit. You're going to talk about Tooth and Claw as well, but this is kind of interesting. You write a bit about this on your website, which is craigallenjohnson.com. It's interesting. This book, at least, is in part about you know, Longmire's and Henry Stenenberg's mortality. And to get into that, you take them back to 1964, where you write they're 10 feet tall and bulletproof. Or are they, you say, right?
Right. Look at, I don't know. I mean, that's one of the things I discovered, you know, whenever I started writing this series, was that you're not, you know, there are a number of different things. You're really stuck, you know, as far as you know, the construction of the novels is concerned. I mean, you really, you know, don't have to use a chronology and use a starting point from the very first novel that you wrote. I mean, you can skip around. You know, you can go forward, you can go backwards, you can do all kinds of things. And I really enjoy going back, you know, in the characters' pasts and discovering, you know, like who they were and what they were and what it is exactly that happened to them to help them to become, you know, who they are now. And, you know, that was a major point in both, you know, Walt and Henry's lives, like that when they were graduating from college and basically lost their deferment and, you know, were going to get drafted, you know, to go to Vietnam. Like that. And, you know, their lives changed a little bit to see, you know, what was going to happen. And so it led to this epic road trip that they were going to have to take across the country on, you know, what other road do you take, you know, in 1964 to drive across the country than Route 66? And so it's got all the makings of this epic road trip. But it kind of gets sidetracked, you know. I mean, the question becomes, you know, how far will they get before they get into trouble? Well, they barely get across the border into Arizona like that before things start happening. And it was a fun book to write because there they were, you know. I mean, they'd been playing college football for 4 years. They're probably in the absolute, you know, physical, you know, top condition of their entire lives, for goodness sake. Like, the bad news being is that they're 22 years old and they're not that smart. Like, and so they make a lot of mistakes. especially with Walt, like that, because he's not particularly trained at this point in time in law enforcement and finds himself in a situation where there's a mystery in this place in Arizona, Bone Valley, like that leads back into World War II. And I think one of my favorite moments, I think, in the book is one of the parts where, you know, Walt says something to Henry where he says, you know, well, you know, don't you think we should obviously, you know, report this to the authorities? And Henry's response to that is, when has that ever really worked out for us? So
that must be fun, as you say, interesting to go back because you've established these characters as adult characters and, you know, move them along in chronology. Now you go back there. I don't know. Is that some freedom to, you know, that they're not as developed back then?
Oh, absolutely, like that. And then you get to see those key elements, you know, that make them who they are. You know, what are the things that happened to them, like that, to help prepare them for being the individuals that they became, you know, in a much more full, you know, full form, like that. And so, you know, and you know, and there are some qualifications that they have, like that, and aspects and, you know, facets of the character, like that are very beneficial, like that, and very helpful. I mean, this is a very physical book, like that, where, you know, Walt has this one individual in this town, like that wants to fight him every time he sees him, like that, you know, and it's almost becomes an ongoing joke, like that, you know, because he has to, you know, fight this guy every single time he sees him, like that. And you know, I don't know if older Walt would have been able to hold up, you know, under the weight of that many fist fights, like that, but you know, certainly 22-year-old Walt, like that, after, you know, 4 years in the trenches of college football, like that, he's pretty game, like that, and he can take it, like that. And I don't know, it was fun to do that. And then, you know, but not only the chronology was different, but obviously I'm dealing with a very different locale like that, because we're talking about, you know, not only the 1960s, but we're talking like Arizona and California in the 1960s. I mean, the book starts, you know, in Malibu, where, you know, Walt and Henry are surfing, for goodness sake, like that, you know, and you know, that's kind of an oddity like that, you know, for a Wyoming sheriff, you know. And so, you know, the ability to be able to move them around and have them in different places, like in different time periods, has kind of been a savior as far as like writing the books is concerned. And, you know, the books that I write, like at most people, you know, the readers enjoy the fact like that they get to move around and change time periods and do all these type of things. I mean, there's some people that don't. I mean, they want the same characters, the same place, the same everything like that. But that's kind of deadly as far as, you know, a writer is concerned, you know, because, you know, readers are going to read a book, you know, they'll read it in what? Like, you know, a couple of days, a week, whatever. I'm writing that book for like a better part of a year, and so it better hold my attention, you know, for the better part of a year, or else, you know, the worst thing in the world that could happen is like you get started on what you think is a good idea and then become bored with it. That's just deadly as far as, you know, as far as writing is concerned.
Has that happened before? You start on something you think, this is not going to work.
You know what I've discovered is it's not so much that the idea won't work, but that the idea might have to work in a different format, which is kind of nice too, like that, because, you know, Penguin Random House is actually pretty great as far as, like, you know, anything I want to write, however I want to write it, you know, is A-okay with them. And, you know, I mean, I remember, you know, first starting writing the short stories like that, and then also the novellas, you know, along with, you know, Tooth and Claw, that'll be coming out on November 19th, like that, which is another, you know, cast back to Walt's past, like that, you know, where we find out he was working security on oil rigs, you know, in Prudhomme Bay in the North Slope, like that, in the 1970s. So it's two different books right here in a row, like that, that actually go back in time, but very, very different books. But I mean, you know, after you write for a while, you know, the adage that I say is that it's kind of like being a gambler at the horse track, you know, and you start looking at stories the same way that gamblers look at horses. You know, you say to yourself, yeah, well, that's a really good idea, like, but that idea is going to develop fast, and I don't know if it's going to be a 400-page idea, but it'd be a really good 200-page idea, you know, or, you know, maybe it's a 30-page idea. You know, you never can tell. But as you get further down the road, like, you do get to the point where you can start telling the difference, you know, of a story that's complicated enough and multi-layered enough that it can actually support a novel, or whether it's going to be a novella or it's going to be a short story, either one.
Well, you've said about Tooth and Claw that it could have been a novel, but you wanted a faster pace, right? To this thing.
Yeah, I'm a serial reader like everybody else, you know. I mean, I find somebody I like, and then I just read everything they ever wrote. And I remember, you know, back in the day when I was, like, you know, a pre-teenager, like that, I discovered Alistair MacLean, the guy that did, High Station Zebra, Where Eagles Dare, Guns of Navarone, you know, and they were these pulpy, you know, macho, you know, thrillers like that were surprisingly well written like that. I mean, he was not a bad writer at all like that, and the complexities of character like that and plot, you know, were really, you know, kind of exciting. And he did them at this like breakneck speed where, you know, things were happening all the time like that. And I remember reading all of his books, and when I started on Tooth and Claw like that, I thought to myself, I thought, you know, because I wrote it, you know, I wrote like the first, you know, maybe, I don't know, two-thirds of it here about 5 years ago like that, and then I put it away, I put it aside, because I thought, you know, it's not turning into what it is I wanted it to be. And so I sat it aside like that, which is sometimes a good idea like that, and then came back to it here about a year ago like that, and thought, let's take a look at this again. So I started in on it again, and what I discovered was that I had lost a little bit of the idea of the tone and the feel and the texture of an Alistair MacLean like that, and I needed to keep that in mind if this was the type of book that I wanted to write. And so I jumped back in, and suddenly that voice and all of that action and pacing and everything all just kind of fell into place. I mean, sometimes you find yourself, you know, writing something that you're just not quite ready to write like that, or you're just not, you know, with it just yet, like it, and it's not responding, the idea isn't like it. And so sometimes the best thing you can do is like take it and put it back in the manila envelope and then put it back up on the shelf and just wait until something will strike. There'll be a moment, you know, or a feeling like it that you'll think, let me pull that back out again and take a look at it. And all of a sudden, you know, it opens up completely. And that's not unusual, even like as a reader. I don't know how many books it is that I've read, you know, or didn't particularly care for, like when I read at a different age, but then later on went back to them and reread them again and was like, wow, this is really good. You know, why didn't I know that those years ago?
It's interesting to think about pace as a, you know, as a reader, it is fun, right? You don't want to incredibly breakneck speed all the time. But for example, that's what I like about Louis L'Amour. It starts like a shot and it's fast paced all the way through.
Oh, absolutely. Like that. And it's a tough thing to teach, too. Like, I mean, you know, the only way that you can really get a good sense of pacing as far as novels are concerned or any kind of writing is concerned is by writing. Like, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you can sit down and do outlines, which help, you know, a great deal. You know, I tend to refer to what I write as kind of socially responsible crime fiction in the sense that, you know, I'm not looking to stack up bodies like cordwood. You know, I mean, I want, you know, there to be a message in this. But, you know, with pacing, it's tough like that because, you know, I mean, you can get a structure together, but that'll help with the pacing, but it doesn't necessarily make for the pacing. And so, you know, you really have to get an idea as far as that's concerned like that. And, you know, readers may not know, you know, they may not, you know, even acknowledge, you know, the pacing, but they'll know if it's wrong. They'll know if something's not there that should be there. And I don't know. I mean, I wish I knew the secrets to it like that, but the only way that I know to develop a sense of that, you know, is simply by writing. The more you write, the more you get that sense of, like, you know, does this work? Is this okay? Is it not okay? And, you know, over the years, you know, you get a feel for it, just like those gamblers at the racetrack.
Yeah, yeah, I guess so. Experience, right? Yeah. Whatever you're into, you get some experience. Well, let's take a break. We'll have much more this hour with Craig Johnson. He's based in Wyoming. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers, the Walt Longmire mystery novels. The latest novel is the 20th in the series. It's called First Frost. And then a novella, Tooth and Claw, is coming out on November 19th. You can find out about that and much else at his website, CraigAllenJohnson.com. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're pleased to be joined by Wyoming-based writer Craig Johnson, New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels, basis for the Longmire Netflix series. The latest novel in the series is the 20th. It's called First Frost. Tooth and Claw novella is coming out on November 19th as well. Find out all about that at the website CraigAllenJohnson.com. So, Craig Johnson, there's a scene in First Frost that just captures the characters, especially Henry Standing Bear. We talked about the humor and also the mortality. These characters, though young, they're confronting their mortality. Then First Frost also transfers back to, I guess, current day Walt Longmire as well. So I just want to read this. So Walt turns to Henry, says, "Do you think I'm not aware that that quarter that I just dropped in the jukebox might be the last song I'll ever hear?" And Henry Standing Bear says, "I think they also have jukeboxes at the USO."
Yeah, he wears the mantle of mortality very lightly. Like, it doesn't, you know, have that much of a large scale effect on him. He's strongly based off of a good friend of mine, Marcus Red Thunder, who's Northern Cheyenne, and it's very difficult. Like, and it's like the old Oscar Wilde statement. I know he's his most serious when he's his most humorous, and that's kind of Henry all over. You know, he's got that philosophy. And, you know, it's a good thing for Walt, you know, because Walt can get a little moribund, look at, and so it's kind of nice, like, that he has someone to help, you know, equal him out a little bit.
Tell me a bit about Marcus. You say Henry's based on him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a little insecure as far as that kind of thing is concerned. So one of the things that I do is that I've got a lot of friends, you know, up on the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation, and so you know, one of my favorite quotes, I think I've quoted it with you before, like, it is the one from Wallace Stegner, where he says, "The greatest piece of fiction ever written is the disclaimer at the beginning of every book that says nobody in this book is based off anybody alive or dead." And what a crock that is! Like, okay, you know, you go out and you find interesting people and populate your novels with them. And then, you know, change the names to, you know, protect the innocent or the guilty, either one, like that. But it makes it a little bit more difficult like that because, of course, you know, I live in a state that only has 500,000 people in it. And then that's even worse up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, where there are only about 3,000 enrolled members of the tribe. And so whenever I use somebody in my books from up there, they all know who I'm talking about. There really isn't any question in their minds. Look at, and so I have to play a little bit fair, you know, with them like that, because everybody knows who it is that I'm talking about, and I don't, you know, want to make mistakes like that. And I don't know. I mean, they're just amazing people, and, you know, it's an opportunity, you know, to bring them forward in the books, you know, because Walt's an outsider. He's a white sheriff, you know, that's adjacent to the reservation, but he's not native, like, and so he's always going to be an outsider like that. But his views, like, and his dealings with the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow, you know, became kind of essential all the way back to The Cold Dish, the very first novel in the series, like, and kind of set a tone. I mean, I knew that there was going to be a spirituality, you know, to the books. You know, you always try and write the books, you know, in as many layers, you know, as you possibly can. And I thought it's probably not going to be a mainstream, you know, kind of mysticism. Like, you know, it's probably going to be, you know, more, you know, dealing with the native issues. Like, just simply because whenever I'm, you know, up there, you know, standing around a campfire like that, or during a powwow or something, or sitting on somebody's porch and everything, I'm fully aware, you know, that my kind of people have only been in this part of the world for a couple of hundred years, whereas, you know, people like Marcus's, you know, family and lineage, they've been here for thousands, like that. And so it's kind of important to make sure that you listen to what it is that they have to say, because they might be a little more knowledgeable about what's going on around us than we are.
So I imagine you get feedback, direct feedback, probably. Hey, that character is based on me. Did they fill your did they fill your fair?
I do. Like, and it was interesting, like, because yeah, there was actually a good friend of mine, Charles Whiteman, like, and it was a tribal elder with the Northern Cheyenne, and he's Lonnie Littlebird in the book, like, it, and it was a dead giveaway because he would always finish his statements with yes, it is so, and so I used that phrase. Well, everybody knew it was Lonnie there, and he was Lonnie. There was no question about it at all, and I changed his name, like, at, you know, from Charles to Lonnie, like, and he, you know, he took me aside and said, you know, I was going to buy, like, you know, 30 or 40 copies of your book and give them to all my friends and show them how famous I am, but then you changed my name, so I'm not going to do it now. So I had a hard lesson to learn there as far as that was concerned, but yeah, it's just too much of a wonderful opportunity to have them be, you know, a part of the books, like, because, I mean, they're a part of Walt's world. It would be, you know, excuse the term, criminal, like, you know, to not have them be involved, you know, with the stories.
I want to talk a little bit more about developing these characters over time. This is the 20th novel. You know, I've talked to other writers who tell me that, you know, you do create the characters, but then they kind of, you know, inform you. And especially over time. Is that true with you, with Walt, with Henry, with the other characters?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I was really, you know, fortunate, you know, because that first novel that I wrote, The Cold Dish, like, it really was a standalone novel. It was just, when you read it, you know, it's got a beginning, a middle, and an end, like that, and it was not meant to be a series at all, like it. And so I really put, like, you know, everything I could put in there, like, to develop those characters, you know, and give them a resonance that would carry, you know, not only through that novel. But as it turns out, here I am 20 years later, like, at still exploring these characters and finding things out about them that I didn't know before. I mean, First Frost is a classic example, you know, of a previous, you know, period in these characters' lives, like, that, where we find out so much more about them than we've ever known before. And, you know, that's nice, like, to be able to go back to the well, you know, that many times, like, and still be able to find, you know, a width and a breadth of character that still keeps them interesting. Because that's a major element. When you start getting bored, you know, with your characters, then you become a little bit formulaic, like, or, disinterested, like that, and that's a dangerous thing to have happen. Like, I wouldn't want to be writing these novels 20 years later, like it, and then discover that I was bored with these characters, because, you know, there's a lot there. There's a lot there to develop, a lot there to play off of. And then it's, you know, it's also, there's a chess move that's going on, you know, consistently too, like that, because, you know, writing a novel in many ways is kind of like conducting a choral group, in the sense that, you know, these voices are there, you know, for a very specific reason. And so, you know, you wouldn't be able to do, you know, a choral piece like it with all basses or all baritones or all alto sopranos or anything like that. So you need to be able to, you know, move those characters in and out. There's a constant flux, you know, of those characters, you know, and I always think about it whenever I'm sitting down and writing the notes, you know, about what it is that I'm doing and how I'm going to do it and what's the story that I'm going to tell and what are the voices that I need, you know, to be able to tell that story. And so, you know, that gives me, you know, an ensemble, you know, to work with as far as the characters are concerned. I mean, there's Walt, there's Henry, there's Vic, there's Lucian. And those are the kind of emails that I get after every, you know, every novel comes out. The first one is you were too hard on Walt, you know, trying, you know, be nicer to him in the next book. Like, and then the other is there was not enough of my favorite character, insert name here. They're fans of all the different characters, and they always want more of their one character than the others. Like, and so it's a little bit of a balancing act, you know, but it always comes down to what does the story need? What's the voices that the story needs?
That's interesting, because you put these characters out in the world, and then they become beloved family members of the readers, right? So there's a bit of a tension there. There's what the reader wants, and then what you as a writer are going to deliver.
Oh, absolutely, like that, and you know, and whatever, you know, their motivations might be, like it, it's always going to be flattering, like it, and you know, I just, you know, whenever someone's upset like that because there was not enough of their favorite character in, you know, whichever book it happens to be, you know, I always tell them, well, don't worry, like that, because it, you know, it's not going to be the same, you know, the same flock of characters and the same amount, you know, in every book, because then you're getting into that, you know, that rut, you know, that you're trying to avoid as much as possible, like that, and I don't know, I'm lucky to have like a really good ensemble of characters, you know, with very different opinions, very different views, you know, and it gives me the ability, like, to kind of stretch a little bit as far as the storylines are concerned.
So this is the 20th book. Are there 20 more? What's in the future?
You know, as you know, like we've discussed this before, like that, one of the dirty little secrets about my books is they're all based off of newspaper articles. You know, what I do is I scour, you know, everywhere I go, like, you know, here in Wyoming, over there in Utah, Montana, and everywhere, like, and I'm always picking up. I love those little weekly newspapers, you know, from the small towns, because they will print stuff that nobody in the rest of the world would ever print. And, you know, anything that has anything to do, you know, with sheriffing, like, you know, native issues, you know, that type of thing, I'm always, you know, grabbing those newspapers, like, and cutting those articles out and putting them, you know, in a, you know, folder, you know, for later use. And, you know, I mean, when I first started out, that was a major concern. Like, that was, you know, well, am I going to have enough here, you know, to continue writing these books, or am I going to get tired? You know, am I going to run out of ideas again? You know, basically is the idea. And I have a file folder now that's probably about 4 inches thick, for goodness sake. Like, and I'm probably going to die before I get all of the, you know, these stories down on paper is the problem like that. But, you know, the key element there, though, is also that I'm still having a good time. I'm having a great time, and there's still more to explore and more to do with these characters. And the next one I've already started, you know, for the book for 2 years from now, and the one that's coming out in the spring is already done. Like that, and I've got all of these other stories that are just begging to be told. Once again, I'm going back to the horse racing, you know, analogy like that. In that, you know, I've got all these stories, and they're like horses, like that, they're jockeying for position to see who's going to get to be the next. And it's fun. It's fun to have that happening.
Yeah, the small town newspapers they can be really fun. There's nowhere else that you can find these days where, you know, so and so visited so and so. For example, right?
Oh, absolutely! Like, and they're very personal. They're very personal in voice. Like, and they will discuss things like in an open, you know, public format that an awful lot of the time, you know, you don't get to see in large newspapers like that, which have to be maybe a little bit more careful.
It's kind of interesting on your website. I love this little anecdote that you share. Your mom asked you what are you going to do when you retire?
Yeah, that kind of it was interesting, like, because I had to explain to her that, you know, well, writers don't really retire, Mom. They just kind of fall over the keyboard, and hopefully you're to the end of a manuscript, you know, when you fall over rather than at the beginning. But yeah, and it still sounds strange. Like, I was just laughing a little earlier there, like that, when you said, you know, wow, 20 books, like it, and whenever, you know, First Frost came out, there was a lot of response, a lot of interviews that basically started off with, wow, 20 books in 20 years, you know, that's really kind of amazing. Like, and I don't know, it seems like I've done all that in like a week or two. I look back and it just seems like it's, you know, time has literally flown by, and I guess that means I'm having a good time like that, because I mean, if it was real drudgery or something I wasn't enjoying like that, it might have felt like 20 years, but it doesn't. It feels like, you know, less than a year.
So that's 20 years with Longmire and associated characters. Do you have plans to do something different? A different character?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've actually started on there's a a literary fiction piece that I'm writing. There's a thriller that I'm writing. There's a historical western that I'm writing. A World War II mystery that I'm working on. And so I've got a bunch of other stuff that I've started on. It's just a question of when the moment strikes. And you pull that folder out. Start in on it again. But life's too short to just do one thing. I think you got to have the opportunity to maybe do some other things and then being with the literary press, they're open to anything I want to do, how I want to do it, which is kind of a wonderful place to be.
Well, let's take another break. We have with us for the hour, pleased to have Craig Johnson, author of the Longmire series, the 20th book now, First Frost, and Tooth and Claw novella comes out November 19th, and then the Christmas story comes out, I guess, soon-ish, Craig Johnson?
Yeah, it'll be out. I'll be traveling around all over the place beginning of December, I would imagine.
Yeah, and you can find out everything at CraigAllenJohnson.com, CraigAllenJohnson.com. We'll have more following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're pleased to have for the hour Wyoming-based writer Craig Johnson, New York Times bestselling author of the Walt Longmire mystery novels. The latest novel, the 20th, is called First Frost, and The Tooth and Claw, a novella, will be released on November 19th. So, Craig Johnson, before we go into the next subject, kind of apropos of nothing, I found very charming on your Facebook page, at least when you're in France there, you had some regular 30 seconds of Zen videos.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, one of the things for me is on social media, there are a lot of authors that just really pound away at you, to buy their books, and I'm like, well, I don't know, that's not, detrimental, for me, it's a place to go have some fun, I don't know, I guess I was up in the Bighorns. I've got a cabin, up about 8,000 feet, and on my way up, I stopped and took a 30-second video one time of, I think it was Hunter Creek, and just a beautiful little spot there, up in the mountains, and put it on there and just started it off and said, here's 30 seconds of Zen, from the Bighorn Mountains in northern Wyoming. And I can't even remember, I don't know, a couple of million hits it got or something like that. And I started thinking about it, and I thought, there are an awful lot of people that are stuck in places where they don't have something nice to look at, or listen to. They're stuck in, little cubicles, in little offices and all that kind of stuff, sitting in traffic or whatever like that. And I thought, maybe doing something once a week, maybe that would be, something, just, a little 30-second video of something. And so I started doing that, I guess about 10 years ago or so, maybe longer than that, and it's become extraordinarily popular. An awful lot of people, kind of count on it. Every Monday, they'll come into work, and hit their Facebook page just to see, what that 30 seconds of Zen is going to be. I don't ever want to forget, that the place where I live is really kind of special. And, I like sharing that with people. I like, saying, well, here's a little bit of this, for your day.
What is your favorite thing about where you live? Wyoming, wonderful place. You're in New Cross, I guess. There's no downtown, probably. But, in this beautiful area, what's your favorite thing?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm always going to be drawn to the mountains. It's just a beautiful place And the isolation is kind of nice too. It's not that there aren't beautiful mountains in a lot of different places But one of the advantages that that northern Wyoming has is there aren't that many people. So it's not like there are multi-billion-dollar ski resorts in the Bighorn Mountains or condos or five-star restaurants or anything like that. It's pretty rustic. Many ways, and I don't know. I guess I think the rustic places are being weeded out little by little, as the population grows, just about all over the planet, and it gets harder and harder to find those open spaces where you can really contemplate. I mean, I think one of my favorite quotes is once again, from Wallace Stegner, where he said, we have to treasure and keep the wild places around us, simply for no other reason than the way that they make us feel when we look upon them. And, you know, I'm a big believer in that. Like, it kind of restored the soul, I think, a great deal to just sit by a stream and listen to the water or, you know, watch the sunshine, you know, glowing, you know, through the leaves as they start to change, you know, all those type of things, or a nice soft snow that starts up, you know, just before dawn. I mean, that's all stuff that's just kind of magic. And you just, it's nice because with what it is that I do for a living, I get the opportunity to describe those things, look at it, and give them to people. And then that kind of makes it all worthwhile.
What about Wyoming as a setting? You've said there's a cinematic sparsity to the West. That's must be, you know, that obviously affects what you write.
Yeah, I think that, you know, well, the description I've heard before, actually, since the two places that we've discussed in the interview, is that, you know, if, you know, France is, you know, an oil painting, you know, then Wyoming is a charcoal sketch, you know, and I like that. I like that. There's a simplicity, you know, and a beauty and an elegance, you know, even, you know, to that sparsity. And, you know, and that's one of the things that I like about Wyoming is that, you know, things become very, very clear. Very quickly, like that, and you know, and in the books, you know, I try and, you know, maintain that, you know, that sparsity to an extent, you know, where you give just enough, you know, for people to get what it is you're talking about, but not so much, you know, that you're choking them with detail. And so, you know, yeah, it's a live world, like that, that, you know, I haven't lost interest in. Like, I mean, I built my ranch here myself, like at NU Cross, like at, you know, I had one of those fathers that thought you were slave labor, you know, until you escaped, like that, and so I learned how to do, you know, basic carpentry work and, you know, electricals and plumbing and all that kind of stuff, like that, and when it came time for me to build my own place, you know, there really wasn't anybody out here to build it, like, because I was kind of out in the middle of nowhere, and nobody wants to really drive all that way out there to work every day to try and build something, and I didn't have much money either, like that, so I kind of had to kind of do it myself. And if you're ever here, I'll walk you through the place and show you every mistake I made.
But, all right.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's home. Like it. And, I don't know. I don't know if I could, I mean, I have a wonderful time, you know, when I'm in places like New York and Paris and all these other places like it. But, I don't know if I could live there. You know, I mean, there's an awful lot of distractions, in those type of places like it. And, you know, Wyoming is pretty great because you can stay focused, and that's hopefully what I've done for the last 20 years.
Yeah. Tell me a bit about the people. It's, you know, some people obviously grow up in Wyoming, places like Ucross. Others come in, right, and seeking, mm-hmm. I guess, I don't know, solitude or to test themselves or the beauty of the surroundings.
Yeah, it's a lot of it like that. I mean, you know, we have this thing called Longmire Days that we have, you know, in Buffalo, like that, where the actors, you know, from the television show all show up, and I'm there, like that, you know, and a couple of, you know, 1,000 people show up, like, for the event. I mean, you know, I think we gave, like, I think $10,000, I think, you know, to the, you know, Blue Christmas Fund this year, which was a local charity with the Buffalo Police Department, you know, for, you know, families, like, at destitute families. And then I think we're also with the Gary Sinise organization. Like that, we're giving them $30,000 or $40,000 too. Like it, and so it makes a lot of money for charity, like that. But there, we have a lot of visitors from a lot of places, from all over the world. And it's kind of interesting because they're here in the summertime and they think it's absolutely spectacular and they want to move here and stay here. And I'm always telling them, yeah, it is like that, but you should also come back like in January or February to get the feel for it when it's the wintertime, like that, because it might be a little bit different than what you suspect.
Yeah, certainly. Wyoming winter. Yeah, that's something. How do you think you've evolved as a writer over this time? I love this quote from another interview. Anything you do for 20 years, you get better at, except drywall, you say.
Well, I'm a firm believer in that statement, I got to tell you, because of all the things I can do, well, drywall ain't one of them. Like, but yeah, I think that, you know, over time what happens is that, you know, there's a raw energy, you know, that you have when you first start out. And, you know, you lose a little bit of that, you know, as the years roll by and you're writing your books. But then again, there's also a certain comfort and a certain I guess you feel as though you know what you're doing. A little bit of confidence starts creeping in, you know, where a lot of that, you know, that insecurity, you know, was still there, like that. And so I think there's a little bit of a switch as far as that's concerned. Not that insecurity as a writer or as any kind of an artist ever completely goes away. At least you hope that it doesn't. Like that, I think that's a key element to being, you know, good at anything. Like you've always got to question yourself. You've always got to say, am I doing the best I can do? You know, am I writing the best books that I can? You know, are these characters still developing? Are they still growing? Are things still changing, you know, for them? And, you know, I think that that's an important thing to hold on to. But, you know, a little bit of confidence where you start getting the feeling that, hey, you know, I might at least have a little bit of an idea of what the heck it is I'm doing here after 20 years. And, you know, hopefully that's the case, you know, because, you know, yeah, I've been writing the books for 20 years like that, but I also write the books in a format that, you know, is seasonal. You know, and so it takes me 4 books to get through 1 year of Walt's life. And so here I am 20 years older than when I first started writing Walt Longmire. Walt Longmire is only 5 years older than when we first met him in The Cold Dish. Okay, so it's interesting to see all the things that have happened to him in this 5 years. It's been a kind of an action-packed 5 years for him, the poor guy.
Yeah, another probably another 5 years to come.
Yeah. I'm hoping so. Look, I mean, I don't see any reason to stop. Look, I'm still having a good time, and there still seem to be, you know, tons of stories to tell, like that, with not only Walt, you know, but with all the other characters in the books too.
Just a couple minutes left here. I was fascinated. You gave an interview to the New York Times. They asked you a bunch of questions. One was, you're organizing a literary dinner party. Which 3 writers that are alive do you invite? I was familiar with several of these, but I was not familiar. I should have been, I guess, with Dorothy Johnson. Tell me about her.
She's one of the great, you know, as far as I'm concerned, unacknowledged, you know, heroes of Western writing. Like, you know, she's from a school marm, like that, you know, from Western Montana, like that. And, you know, she wrote shorter novels like that, which obviously appealed a great deal to Hollywood, like that, simply because, you know, they hit fast and hit the ground running. And, you know, she did A Man Called Horse. She did The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, The Hanging Tree. There are all of these wonderful, wonderful stories that she wrote. And then a number of, like, nonfiction books that she also wrote. Look at, but just a marvelous, marvelous writer, with a true understanding, I think, of the West and Western people. And she doesn't get as much credit as she deserves. She most certainly, you know, deserves a little bit more of a, you know, recognition like that than she's gotten over the years. You know, I still think, you know, that The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, like that, is not only, you know, one of the best short novels like that, but also an incredible movie. It's just a marvelous film. But you know, Pete, you can quote, you know, all kinds of, like, things from that. You know, I mean, as far as, like, you know, this is the West. You know, when the legend becomes fact, you know, you print the legend. You know, and so she had a wonderful understanding like that of place, like that, and you know, she didn't hold back either, like that. You know, a lot of her, you know, stuff didn't necessarily happen in the Hollywood portion of, like, the western part of Montana, but in the eastern kind of outlawish part. And she'll always be one of my favorites, I have to admit.
You also list in that interview Tony Hillerman. Yeah, I think he's been an influence on you.
Oh, absolutely, like that. I mean, when I was first starting out, I had, like, one book. And I, you know, had a short story which was how it is that I got started writing short stories every year. That was in Cowboys and Indians magazine, like that one that was the Tony Hillerman Cowboys and Indian magazine Mystery Short Story Award. And I think that, like, you know, probably the title of the contest was longer than a lot of the submissions. But, you know, I entered it like that and won like that. And one of the great things was I got to go have dinner with Tony Hillerman. And I think I learned more in those, you know, 4 hours having dinner with Tony than I did in a master's degree. He just had such a very clear idea of, you know, what it is that we do and how we do it. And he was also extraordinarily generous. He was an amazingly generous man. Not everybody in the field is as open and friendly and as helpful like as Tony was. But that was just his nature like that. I mean, when you read his books, you know, anytime you read anybody's books, if you read them closely enough, you get a very strong idea about who that person is. Like that, I mean, you know, I spend 8 hours a day with these characters like that, and if somebody's reading my novels, you know, then I'm spending more time with them than I am with my family. So I better, you know, size it up and do a good job. But he was a key element as far as that was concerned. You know, he had such a strong sense of place, you know, in the Southwest there. I was trying to replicate that, you know, with my sense of the High Plains area. And you know, hopefully, like, you know, I'll be able to stand up to the, you know, the legend, you know, as he is.
Well, we've reached the end of our time here. Craig Johnson has been our guest here, Wyoming-based writer, New York Times bestseller of the Walt Longmire mystery novels. And the latest in the series is the 20th. It's called First Frost. That's out and available. And Tooth and Claw novella will be released on November 19th. You can find out all about Craig Johnson at his website, craigallenjohnson.com. Craig Johnson, always such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, this is. Like, I look forward to these interviews like every year. Like, they're just so insightful and so wonderful and different, you know, than what everybody else does. Like, it's just a marvelous opportunity. So thank you again.
Well, right back at you. I'd love talking to you. Well, good luck with everything, and appreciate the conversation.
You bet. I'll get some books out to you.
Okay, great. Thank you. Very good.
You bet.
Very good. Thanks, Craig Johnson. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.